Hello, this is Mark Shanton welcoming you to Theatre Voice's latest regular critical roundup of the most notable recent London theatre openings. I'm joined today by critics Charles Spencer of the Daily Telegraph, Matt Wolfe of the International Herald Tribune, and David Benedict from Variety to discuss two play premieres and the import of a hit Broadway musical. Two of them are based on real-life biographical stories. In Jersey Boys, which has come to the Prince Edward Theatre, the lives and careers of the men that comprised 60s pop hitmakers Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons are tracked against the soundtrack of the songs that they made famous. While in Never So Good, now running at the National's Littleton, it is Harold Macmillan, Britain's Prime Minister from 1957 to 1963, whose life is charted from Eton schoolboy days to active service in the First World War, his subsequent marriage, and government service that included being Minister of Defence and Chancellor of the Exchequer before becoming Prime Minister. And for matters of state, the arrival of Yasmina Reyes's latest Paris hit, God of Carnage, at London's Gielgud Theatre, reunites her with the team behind her international hit play Art, including translator Christopher Hampton, director Matthew Warchus, and designer Mark Thompson, for another of her dissections of the intricate politics of personal relationships, this time amongst two professional couples who meet to discuss the injury that the son of one couple has inflicted on the son of the other and come to different sorts of blows themselves. The West End first night for God of Carnage was disrupted by another sort of event when the lights literally went out owing to a power cut. Charlie, you were there. How did that affect the performance?
Well, they managed it brilliantly, really. In fact, actually, it was the sort of people on the other side of, you know, the technical side, who didn't do quite so well because I think they should have just kept going, but they stopped the show. Maybe they should have had a quick announcement, and then they sort of fussed around a bit backstage. But the four very starry members of the cast were completely unfazed about it. And although, I mean, normally they say, you know, the lighting creates the energy of a show to a large extent, but actually there was no loss of energy, and they skipped back. And they also had this other thing where it wasn't just the lighting. Ralph Fiennes has this constant mobile phones going off as a running joke through the show, and it wasn't ever ringing, so he had to sort of anticipate his mobile going off. It was a real sort of one of those nights when what a wonderful lot of old troopers they were, you know.
But it was a play that, of course, depends on the comic momentum and the comic motor. What did you think, David, of the play?
I think the play is like most of Yasmina Reyes's plays, that they're not quite as good as the playwright thinks they are, but they're an awful lot better than their detractors would have you believe. I think this is, in a bad production, you would notice quite how portentous some of the writing is. And certainly in a bad translation, you really would notice it. I think she's extraordinarily lucky in Christopher Hampton, whose translations are fantastically felicitous. I think this has got some quite heavy weather in it, but you don't notice it because it's such an expert production from absolutely everybody, whether that's, you know, clean music at the top, Hugh Vanston's lighting,
that of which we saw,
the whole deal, Mark Thompson's designs, Matthew Watch's direction, and an absolutely crack playing by a cast. It was like watching championship doubles, except that everybody kept switching sides. Nobody drops the ball all night long. And as Charlie says, the fact that the ball did get dropped for 10 minutes whilst they sorted out lighting cues and what they were going to do in their absence, the fact that they were able to pick it all back up again was kind of extraordinary. Although audiences do love it. When you're reminded that theatre really is live.
I liked it. I think there's something about it, you know, and it does remind you that it is, you know, that things can go wrong, and it's so rare that you get that.
And also, these days, when robbed of all the technicalities, they've just brought up the working lights. You really are left with the fact, okay, what is happening here is four people are doing lines and making us believe that it happens. And the fact that they were able to drag everybody back into the height of an argument
very quickly,
did really make you feel like, oh, actually, I'm watching really good acting. This is a damn well-oiled machine, really, really working.
I think you're absolutely right, though, about Razor. I mean, she's so lucky. I mean, I don't reckon she has many jokes. I'm sure a lot of those jokes are Hampton's. And then Pugh assembles these beautiful casts for her, you know. I mean, I think this is one of Pugh's very best casts, actually.
Absolutely.
A really cracking cast. And Particularly Ralph Fiennes, I thought was a revelation to me, because he'd always struck me as a bit of sort of carrot up the bum actor, and here he was playing a man with a carrot up the bum, but sending himself up rather nicely.
I mean, I did think Fiennes was good. I found his performance particularly one note.
Yes.
It happens to be the right note, yes. Thank goodness. Whereas I think the others are doing rather extraordinary things. I mean, the point about Razor is she never writes about what she appears to be writing about. Art was supposedly a play about art. It was nothing of the sort. It was a play about male friendship. This is supposedly about the lack of sophistication and how we're all savages really, and this, that and the other. Actually, that's what she's writing about. She pretends it's a play about what are we going to do about our children beating each other up, and of course it isn't about that. But just the energy of what is going on between them, the fact that actors can pick up on the comic element of this, and because, as you say, with what Hampton is doing, it's a much slighter play than she believes it to be. But whilst you're watching it, you just buy it, because the playing is so good. Yeah. And everybody else, other than Fiennes, has this two-dimensional quality. And particularly Tamsin Gregg, I thought, who starts off quite slowly. I mean, there's a fantastic piece of design in this. I mean, it sounds disgusting, but she gets so tense that she throws up. I mean, it's just the most incredible pyrotechnic effect.
How does she... Did you work out how they did it?
There's a tube. She's got a very wide bracelet on one arm that will have a tube up the side of it, and I assume that she's got her hand to her mouth. So
this is what's known in internet parlance as a spoiler. however, it's not the only vomit scene.
It happens quite early, but that's done incredibly well. But she starts off a sort of demure, trying to ameliorate the situation. The two couples meet in the apartment. They're trying to sort out the statement they're going to make, because one of the children has beaten up the other one, hit him in the face with a stick, and two teeth have been lost. And she's the wife of the aggressive child, the mother of the aggressive child, and she's just trying to be placatory, and you think that's her role, but actually you begin to see her as this oppressed wife of Ralph Fiennes, and there's a sort of maniacal glee. There's something that she does, which I won't spoil later on in the play, that the audience is so happy when she finally does. She takes revenge, and she releases this sort of maniacal laugh of happiness that she's done it, which is really rather shocking, and you suddenly see this enormous emotional wellspring beneath that demure surface.
No, she's a lovely actress. I thought the one thing that doesn't work, actually, and you don't realise it at the time, it's only afterwards, is actually the marriage between the other couple, which is Ken Stott and Janet McTeer. Those two they would never have been married. I mean,
Certainly wouldn't have lasted as long
as they
seem to have.
No, it's, because she's a sort of earth mother peacenik, and he's a nasty little racist misanthrope, really. Mm. And it's not a real marriage, that. And I think that's the thing with Razor Plays. While you're watching them, they're absolutely enjoyable, but they are absolutely no substance, really. And
they're soufflés.
They're soufflés, and they're very nice for 90 minutes. They don't outstay their welcome, and then you forget all about them.
But I mean, you know, there's, to my mind, a thoroughly second-rate revival of Vortex next door. I'd sit through The God of Carnage three times rather than see The Vortex again. It's very, very skilled, and as I say, when it's done as well as this, it's thoroughly enjoyable. The audience was having a damn good time.
Yeah, they did love it.
She is kind of repetitious, though, isn't she? I mean, the play is always endlessly loop around themselves. They're internally repetitious, and then between each play, they're repetitious, and it's accentuated, I think, by the fact that the same design, director team, translator team approach them each time. Lifetime 3. This felt to me like a real rerun of Lifetime 3.
Oh, I think it's a much better play than Lifetime 3.
Which was a rerun of itself, because it repeated itself twice over.
She's got tricks, and she uses them, hasn't she? Yeah. It's the old term, it's the classic boulevard comedy, you know. Yeah. And funny enough, I was in Paris, where it's on at the moment, and they have plays there that you just don't see here at all, you know, they're all these sort of slightly sort of old-fashioned looking farces and comedies, and which is absolutely the mainstay of French theatre, and of course it fits in very well with that. Though she, of course, would not say they're boulevard comedies.
She calls them tragedies.
Yes.
Silly old
cow. She's...
But one of the interesting things I think is also is the fact that she's one of the few commercial playwrights to open a play cold in the West End, and she has a kind of ongoing relationship with David Pugh, the producer, which once upon a time would have happened. Michael Codron had ongoing relationships with Akeborn, with Stoppard, and so on, and he would bring plays of theirs into the West End. There's very little of that about now.
Well, interestingly, you say that because that is the perception, but in fact, Pugh has only done one Razor play before. He right. did not do Lifetimes 3. He did not do The Unexpected Man. He wasn't particularly fond of them.
Yeah.
Actually, he's chosen very wisely. I think, you know, this one looks like having the same kind of commercial legs that Art has done. You know, it's a play about parents looking after their children. It's fairly universal. That could certainly cross to America very easily. Yeah. And it, you know, she premiered it herself in Switzerland. It is, as Charlie says, it's playing with Isabelle Huppert in Paris currently. This is going to have a track record.
It's a franchise, isn't it?
And of course, the stalls was full the other day of people who'd been in Art, and you sort of sat there wondering, you know, is Warren Mitchell going to take over from Ralph Fiennes, perhaps? there were all those sorts of worries. Meanwhile, moving on to Never So Good. Good enough for you, David?
I think that I could be very mean and say that I think the title is wrong, which would be So Good, Never. I don't think it's as bad as that, but I do think that it's an awful lot of playwriting ideas in search of a play. It, for me, had absolutely no tension, no narrative drive. It wasn't until the beginning of the second act that I worked out why Howard Brenton had written the play. Jeremy Irons is very nice. There's some good work by Vicky Mortimer, but it really didn't do it for me in spades, I have to say.
Did it do it for you, Matt?
Well, the interesting thing about this play for me is that obviously Harold Macmillan wasn't part of my childhood or my history or my upbringing. So I went to it really as a sort of novice, and I was surprisingly engaged, I have to say. I mean, I see what David is saying about why he wrote it, because whenever somebody makes a bio play or a biopic, you sort of assume it's about something more than itself. I mean, obviously, there was some sort of motor by which I assume Howard Brenton, that one-time socialist firebrand, is actually writing a deeply sympathetic portrait of a statesman who, you know, 20 years ago, presumably he couldn't have been less interested in. But it's about levels of statesmanship, sort of a kind of morality which has completely vanished. The problem with these sorts of plays, and it's actually slightly true of Jersey Boys, is that they always succumb to, and then what happened, yes. And then what came next. And it's very, very hard to end them. We can talk more about that later.
Yes, there's an awful lot of history in this, isn't there? And of course, Brenton has written plays about Churchill. He's also written plays about Paul, most recently at the National, and in Extremis at the Globe. He's in a history cycle, isn't he, Charlie?
Yes, I mean, I think this is an absolutely terrific play, actually. I mean, I think it's a play about, I think actually, if you're looking for the subject, it's a play about England and how England has changed. I think that's why he wanted to write it. And I think that I think it's an absolutely extraordinary, one of the most startling examples of an artist reinventing himself that I can remember, actually. I mean, the idea that 30 years after the Romans in Britain, he would be writing a play that is incredibly sympathetic to Macmillan. I mean, there is not hardly an ounce. I think you know, you could accuse Macmillan of being quite a lot of not very nice things, and Brenton doesn't. I mean, he makes him very sympathetic. He makes him slightly ruthless, but certainly not really, really ruthless. And even when he's out of touch, he gives him good lines at the end. I was terribly moved, I mean, I suppose, as someone on the right, to see someone from the left finding such sympathy in this man, which I think gives it, you need that, if you bring that knowledge to the play, it does add an extra depth. I thought that the relationship between the sort of public, you know, the public affairs, and then that very sad relationship with his wife was beautifully caught. And just things like, you know, familiar territory, but beautifully done. The First World War scenes, fantastically well done, I thought. And I thought that the Suez thing, also well known and familiar, was done like a sort of thriller. You could see that he'd done Spooks. I thought it was a fantastic evening, actually, and the National at its very best, and Irons, not an actor I normally like, very good. Though I don't think actually quite as persuasive as Edward Fox was 10 years ago.
In a letter of resignation at the comedy.
But a lovely performance from Irons, and I thought there was less of the vanity you normally get in his acting.
Yeah.
I did think that the Suez scene, which is what... basically, the Suez Crisis, the famously shameful episode in British politics that many a playwright discusses, David Hare often mentions it in various plays. that's the best part of the play for me by a long chalk, because it finally gets its teeth into something. I mean, it's partly because he's very, very clearly drawing parallels with, you know, another more recent foreign policy adventure, which was all about looking after oil, according to Brenton, i.e. the Iraq War. And the parallels are unmissable in the lines that are given to various people. And that bit is dramatised. But so much of the rest of it is, as Matt says, and then play, so much of it is discussion. And I completely take your point, Charlie, that it's fascinating that a left-wing playwright is so sympathetic to a right-wing politician. Fascinating from a authorial point of view, but unfortunately for me, it almost never span into drama. And the points at which we see time gaps, we see a shift in time, a whole group of dancers come on the stage and dance. Do they dance for 30 seconds, 1 minute, a minute and a half, or 2 minutes? There's absolutely no reason for them to be there other than to pass time. They come on, it's completely dramatically inert. And there are so many other bits where you see hoary old devices of the young man and the old man interrogating each other. That's never really taken far enough. It's just the young man becomes the voice of his conscience, who pricks him occasionally. There are very, very interesting discussions about the responsibilities of power, about a paternalistic conservatism, which is there presumably to make us think about different types of conservatism now. But it's a discussion. It's not, for me, it's not a drama.
Well, part of me felt that maybe, you know, with this kind of play, one of the fascinating things about Frost Nixon, I think, was that Peter Morgan didn't attempt to dramatize all of Frost's life from cradle to grave, or all of Nixon's life. He focused on one salient moment and then brought enough information to the table to charge it up. And I couldn't help but wonder with this, although I'm not quite sure what moment it would have been, whether there could have been one moment from Macmillan's life which could have been emblematic of the whole, rather than trying to embrace everything with exactly the same approach that Tom Stoppard employed in The Invention of Love, very much more movingly, I thought, in The Invention of Love. I thought after a while Brenton didn't quite know what to do with this younger, older self thing, and he kind of abandoned it.
Well, he does cover like 50 years or more.
That's what I like about it as much as anything. And I think it's actually got a lot in common with Coward's Cavalcade and all those, and 40 Years On. It's a pageant in a way.
Yes.
But I find, if you find yourself immersed in the character, it becomes extremely moving, and it is actually what happened to England and what happened to people in England. I think it gets better almost than any play I've ever seen as well, that ending of The Age of Deference, where at the end he just does not understand that Peter Cook can stand up and insult him to his face in the club. And yet there is something almost heroic about it. He takes it with dignity and then says he goes off and enjoys his period of old fartdom. And I loved it. And I actually think that this will be a very big hit. I think it's a sort of play a lot of people are going to want to see.
It won't play on Broadway. But that's not a slight.
Well,
No. I'm not saying that as a slight.
And actually, I preferred it to... I greatly preferred it to Frost Nixon, which I thought was too centred on one thing. And actually... was like a documentary more than a play. I mean, it was beautifully acted, I absolutely agree, but I didn't think it was much of a play. I think this is a much better play. Possibly baggier and looser and not so well constructed, but richer and more rewarding.
It's interesting the way Jeremy Irons all of a sudden seems to have leapfrogged from kind of young gay blades in The Rover and The Real Thing to playing old men.
Well, he hasn't been on stage for such a long time
the
two.
But he seems to have missed that middle ground, and now he's playing geriatrics. I mean, that unendurable Embers last year, which was... appalling. I mean, this is
acclaimed by Nicholas de Jong as one of the most greatest theatrical experiences.
Yes,
of his
even
life.
Though he only gave it 4 stars out of 5, and then this—you sort of wonder what happened to Jeremy Irons.
Yes, it was
middle ground.
Of course, this is a play that I think only the National can do. In fact, because you look at a cast up there, 23 people I counted at the curtain call, and also that very spectacular Act One finale, which I don't want to spoil again. Which, if you were asleep, you would certainly be awoken by. I was sitting next to the chairman of the National Theatre on the press night, and he turned to me and said, I don't know how we get these things through health and safety. it was rather remarkable. Talking of health and safety brings us to Jersey Boys. Did it improve your health, Charlie?
Yeah, well, it left me very cheerful. I'm a pop buff, and actually, just to go back very, very quickly, the dance routines weren't as good as they could be, but I thought it was an absolute joy in that in the Macmillan play to hear... the full-length version of Shaking All Over by Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, which is something you don't get nearly often enough, in my view, and it was a very, very well-chosen song as well. Jersey Boys, I've never been much of a one for the Four Seasons. I actually, on record, find Frankie Valli's famous falsetto de trop, really, and a little of it goes a long way for me. I saw this show in New York, and where, of course, New Jersey is just across the border, or the river, not the border. River, but yes. I suppose it's a border as
it's
well.
It's a border it's now. A state. Everything in New York has a border now.
I liked it there, and I liked it just as much here. I still can't quite see why I liked it so much, in that it's a very old-fashioned jukebox musical. It's the kind of jukebox musical that Bill Kenwright used to do about Roy Orbison and Patsy Cline. And, you know, it just tells the story.
But it's so much more stylishly.
The story is an interesting one, you know, because you've got the mob connections and things. And the songs are very good in the theatre. They work fantastically, I mean, which is not always the case. They do work well as theatre songs, don't they? But I still can't quite see why I liked it so much, but I did. And I think the big question now is whether there will be enough sort of people, Four Seasons fans, who will go and see it here. Though I have to say I didn't go on the first night. I went on a Saturday night before it opened, with permission. And it was getting a kind of blue-collar audience, which is what they seem to be, a very blue-collar band. I mean, that makes a lot of that there. It was the kind of Essex audience, and we all know what the Essex audience have done to We Will Rock You, and I think actually it might have much longer legs than people are suggesting.
Although Queen are bigger, obviously, than Frankie Valli. But, yeah. But the thing is, we've seen so many of those terribly bad compilation musicals over here, and I think that's the thing, secret of this.
It's well-written. And
it's well-written and very well-produced. I mean, compare it to Buddy, which is shamefully lacklustre dramatically. I mean, of course, you get the payoff with the big songs, but I suppose Buddy, because he's dead, has a bigger legacy. I mean, these guys, you know, both Frankie Valli and Bob Gardia were sitting in the theatre the other night. But I think that's probably part of the reason for its success. Matt, you saw it on Broadway too.
Yeah. Well, it's fantastically, fantastically well directed. I mean, Des McAnuff's direction of this does bear comparison with Michael Bennett's direction of Dreamgirls, and that is saying a lot. And it has that same sort of quicksilver energy and almost kind of cinematic cuts, and it's just sentimental enough to get the women in the audience on its side, but it's also got a kind of macho gristle to it, which gets the blokes on its side. It's quite a blokey show.
Oh, it is, yes.
And I think that will work on its behalf here, as it has on Broadway. I mean, I suppose inevitably, coming from New York, it seemed to me here to be kind of a facsimile of the thing rather than the thing itself. I didn't go to the press night either. I went to the Monday night preview, and it was very odd because they were coming out on stage saying things like, "Hey, New Jersey!" You know, cue for a huge ovation from audience, dead silence. And you thought, uh-oh, they really had to be goosed along. But then
perhaps
they
should prevent the Jersey Boys came from Epping Forest, and it would then become a very great...
Guernsey.
Exactly. Or Old Compton Street, the boys' bit. But, you know, as soon as you have the kind of incredibly muscular intro to Walk Like a Man, or all of a sudden the swooping sort of explosion of Sherry, it's really exciting on a very visceral level. Although, for me, this cast doesn't really get it from the inside the way the New York cast does, but I think that's probably inevitable.
It does take a long time to get going, actually, the show. I mean, there's a good 45 minutes before you get into Sherry's, the launch of the Jersey
Boys. I think that's a sign of its courage, actually.
I do too. Yes.
And I find all that stuff about... I mean, bands are always more interesting before they make it than when they have made it. And I find all that sort of stuff, I mean, keep going to prison and in trouble and sort of bungled robberies and false murder, you know, false murder facades and really terrible songs. The only disappointing thing is they don't feature nearly enough Bob Gaudio's Short Shorts, which not many of you will know. It was a hit here covered by Freddie and the Dreamers. I'm sorry to go into all this detail. And it's actually one of the great camp songs of all times. We're going, "I like short shorts, do you like my short shorts?" It's a fantastic song, and it's only mentioned en passant.
Well, they couldn't include everything, could they? But one of the slightly misleading things they do is that in the show you get the sense that Bob Gaudio wrote everything, and if you look in the credits, he actually didn't write a great deal of these songs, or co-wrote them with the guy who's like the camp aside.
I mean, I do think that, I mean, I have not seen the show in London, but I like Matt saw it in New York. I I am slightly mystified by this because everybody says, oh, it's so well written. And I'm really puzzled as to why it is. I think it's extremely competently written. I mean that in a positive way. It sounds like damned with faint praise. I think it's extraordinarily efficient. But I'm not sure it's anything more than that. And watching it in New York, I began to get worried. I mean, all around me, I went on a Saturday matinee months into the run, and as you say, the Jersey Lines come up and the audience just, you know, has an orgasm. It's fantastic. It's local boys made good. And on the Prince Edward and Old Compton Street, local to where? And I do worry that whilst I too love Oh What a Night and plenty of other Frankie Van and Four Seasons numbers, how many people are willing to risk, you know, two of you go, it's £100.
120.
Thank you. 100, 120 quid to go and see this, when actually you can download a couple of the tracks from iTunes, whack your stereo up and have a damn good time listening to them.
Well, the funny thing about Jersey Boys here compared to Broadway is that there are many more shows of its sort here. That yes. whole genre has been pioneered, or some would say bastardized, largely by producers we could name, on the West End. And that sort of show doesn't get a look in New York. I mean, Buddy famously flopped out of the Schubert Theater after about, 8 months?
Yeah.
And has been playing here for decades.
Lennon and Good Vibrations came and went within seconds.
Yes, although I did manage to see it. So I wonder whether in New York it doesn't represent something a bit more novel and unusual, whereas here people are going to just think, oh, not another one.
I don't know. I think that's true. I mean, I took a New Yorker to see Josie, and she was completely bamboozled by the whole thing, you know. I'm not quite sure what they're doing. I mean, maybe we've reached a point where the term musical simply isn't enough, because what you and I might think of a musical and what two other people might think of as a musical maybe and indeed are completely different things, and that this kind of compilation show, a stitched together history where in which the songs get played out, is a very different thing, and that, as you say, we've cornered the market in that. There have been Roy Orbison shows and virtually every single person. And there are many more circuiting and ready to come in. We were promised a Tina Turner one from Ben Elton, which hasn't actually seen the light.
I would love that one. That'll
yeah, obviously.
Speak to me,
and there's a Dusty Springfield one waiting in the wings. You know, anybody that's had more than four hits is clearly ready and waiting for an impersonator.
Well, my Janis Joplin musical in the bottom of the drawer. That has been
will you be giving us your Janis?
I'm ready for that one.
Well, I think on that note, thank you, David, Charlie and Matt.